It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors learned late last week that the county's contract for health insurance through United Healthcare expired at the end of 2025.
That prompted an emergency meeting yesterday to the county board's finance and personnel committees to approve a new contract that will go before the full 18-member Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors on Thursday.
During the contract lapse, the county's over 5,000 employees and retirees still had health insurance coverage, but officials said continuing to operate without a new contract created significant risk for the county.
We're learning more now about what led to that mistake and what happens next for Milwaukee County.
Evan Casey is a reporter for WPR covering the greater Milwaukee area and southeast Wisconsin. He's been covering the recent county board meetings and the health insurance issue. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, walk us through the timeline here of how the county board first found out about this health insurance contract lapsing. When did it come to light?
Yeah, so last week there was a regularly planned finance committee meeting at the county level, and county supervisors were set to approve a new contract with United Healthcare. But it was only learned during that meeting that the old one had expired at the end of last year. So they were operating for a few weeks now without a new contract in place with United Healthcare. So obviously that raised some red flags by county supervisors who were just worried and concerned and angered about how this happened.
County supervisors, 18 of them, you know, they set policy, they you know, adopt an annual budget. What was their reaction?
Yeah, it was, some of them were obviously rightfully so very angry. Others were just shocked. One told me yesterday she was just in disbelief that this happened. You know, Supervisor Steve Taylor, who I talked to on Friday, was probably the most angry. He just had no idea like how this happened and just was in disbelief as well. So, and you know, some county supervisors, you know, said during a meeting yesterday, they heard from county employees like over the weekend and over the past few days about just their concerns about like, do I have coverage? You know, I have a big operation coming up in a week or two. Am I going to be covered for that? So, you know, that anger, I think, is rightfully so from a lot of these supervisors.
Certainly very scary with a life event like an operation. So county employees, they still have health insurance coverage despite this contract expiring with United Healthcare. And let's listen to how Milwaukee County Policy Director Jeremy Lucas described the relationship during yesterday's meeting.
We are self-insured for purposes of providing care. So it's that claims administration piece that we're purchasing. And then the second piece is we're buying into UHC's in-network providers. Their managed care network is what it's referred to as. And so through that network, UHC has negotiated reduced provider rates.
So, Evan, if county employees still have coverage, then what are county leaders concerned about without the contract? What are the potential consequences if this isn't remedied?
The county's attorneys last week said there could be a quote-unquote catastrophic risk if the county doesn't move forward to approve a new contract soon. They said the ability for county employees to receive and pay for services could be affected. Another county attorney also said if an employee does have a large claim before a new contract is signed, that could leave United Healthcare in a position to deny it. All that being said, though, it does sound like county supervisors, you know, made it pretty clear yesterday that there really shouldn't be any big issues regarding this. The fact that there isn't a new contract in place. But even so, I mean, county employees are still like, you know, probably pretty concerned here.
We have heard that one county employee has been released from their job. What do you know about how this happened? What was the explanation given to board members?
Yeah, so that former employee now addressed the county board or the county committee last week. He said that last year, you know, he went with an RFP or a request for proposal process for the new contract. That was last year, I believe in May. He told, you know, county supervisors that he had hired an outside contractor to do that RFP. And that's basically not something that the county allows or is, you know, regulated for right now. So he went against the county ordinances in doing so. It also looks like there's some back and forth about this contract with the county comptroller's office. And it sounds like there basically was kind of just a lapse in communication in discussing kind of some of the terms and agreements in this new contract with UnitedHealthcare. And then basically it looks like, communication broke down and basically stopped regarding this until it was brought up to the committee last week. When this HR employee brought it forward for approval, the county comptroller's office, they were there in attendance and obviously raised a lot of concerns about this, said they still haven't had a chance to review this contract, and had even told, they're the ones who told the county supervisors as well that the old contract had expired. So, yeah, that former employee, it looks like he was let go by the county over the past few days here.
So I want to stick with that for a moment in the controller's office. In your story, you write that County Controller Liz Sumner told board members last week the new contract did not meet the county's current standards. Do you know what Sumner meant by that? How does it not meet standards?
Yeah, so the county supervisors and the county comptroller's office, they have some concerns about the fiscal estimate regarding the contract. And basically, members of the county's administration yesterday, addressed the supervisors regarding that and said that they would work to get some of those estimates and answer some financial questions regarding, some of the costs that the county could incur regarding this new contract. They're going to look to do that before Thursday because Thursday is when the full county board is going to meet to approve or deny this contract. It was, like I mentioned, approved by the county, the finance committee yesterday. So on Thursday, the full board is going to meet to approve or deny this.
WPR reporter Evan Casey is with us, covers the greater Milwaukee area and has been reporting on Milwaukee County's health insurance contract that expired at the end of last year and the fallout from this benefit lapse and how the County Board of Supervisors is responding to it. So during yesterday's meeting, Milwaukee County Chief Human Resources Officer Margo Franklin spoke and described a key point of communication breakdown with the employee who was responsible for the new healthcare contract. Let's take a listen. Here's what she said about when the contract was left in limbo.
In September, there was outreach to the audit department around the audit clause language, and there was some back and forth. That happened for about a couple of days. And then based on emails that I could see, the conversations stopped. And that is the part that I don't know what happened.
The conversation just stopped. What kind of oversight or stop gaps did Supervisor discuss for trying to prevent something like this from happening, from falling through the cracks?
Regarding that, I mean, one county supervisor said that was embarrassing, like that this could happen. And they were just shocked at how this could happen. Basically, it sounds like all county supervisors were on the same board about having just better communication between these departments regarding some of these huge contracts. I mean, this is probably the biggest contract and most important contract in Milwaukee County. So it was, they just said it was embarrassing. One county supervisor also mentioned that there was a dashboard that she'd like to see departments be using now in the county regarding some of these big contracts so that, they could be on the same page about deadlines and approval of these contracts. So it sounds like that might be something that county supervisors move to do as well sometime soon here.
So it sounds like they really want to see the step-by-step process and see exactly where things are. Let's step back, look at Milwaukee County Executive David Crawley's response. He didn't respond to our interview request, but he did put out a statement. It says, "This was an error by an employee in the Department of Human Resources, and as a result, that employee no longer works for Milwaukee County," end quote. How much of the blame here are they assigning to one fired employee versus the other pieces of this and people taking accountability?
Yeah, I saw that statement too yesterday. It does sound like, they believe and the HR department does believe that it's really up to this one employee. So it could stop there. But I don't know. I mean, he did put out a longer statement on Monday regarding, just he wanted to see this new contract approved. He said that he's working with county administration and supervisors to approve this contract and to answer any questions that they have. And that statement also said that, quote unquote, "we need to strengthen our internal system and enhance safeguards for contract management." So that's what he said. But yeah, same here. I haven't had a chance to sit down with him and talk with him about this as well.
Has he been hands-on in this cleanup? Has he been front and center in responding to all of this, or has he deferred to county officials? What do you see in the reaction of County Executive David Crawley in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, all I've seen personally is just a statement on Friday. He sent out a one-sentence statement. Monday, yesterday, like I mentioned, was a longer statement regarding the fired employee. He hasn't had a press conference yet about this. I don't think he's done any interviews regarding this yet. So I guess we'll see, if he's open to that down the road.
And this is getting political, Evan, with Crawley in the Democratic primary for governor. How have you seen other candidates respond to these developments?
Yeah, Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany, who is obviously running against him in the race for governor as a Republican, he basically took to social media to say, quote unquote, if Crowley can't run a county, how is he going to run a state? So he's obviously weighed in. During a press conference yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez, who is also running against Crowley but as a Democrat, she also said she believes there was a, quote, breakdown in leadership regarding this. So she said it was scary and unfortunate that it happened. I did reach out to Crowley's campaign as well. They told me in a statement that, Crowley is, quote unquote, the only candidate who has real hands-on experience solving these kinds of problems. So that was their response.
So if the full county board, the 18 members, they approve the new health insurance contract Thursday, does that put a closure to this, or do you expect there to be more fallout at future meetings?
Yeah, I doubt it. I do think that the county board, there's likely to be maybe some resolutions or some efforts soon to kind of make sure this doesn't happen again. Because, like I mentioned, a lot of county supervisors said this was just embarrassing and just shocked that this could happen. So, my guess, if I were to guess, I would say that there could be some measures by county supervisors to make sure that, this is never going to happen again with any contracts, not just healthcare.
Evan, thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Evan Casey is a reporter for WPR covering the greater Milwaukee area in southeast Wisconsin. He was with us today to bring us the latest on this lapse in Milwaukee County's health insurance contract and how local officials are responding to it.
Coming up, after 8 years, the court-mandated oversight of two Wisconsin youth prison facilities has come to an end. An attorney at the Juvenile Law Center tells us what's changed.
Making the whole culture better at the facilities is what has allowed for there to be, an overall improvement in safety for the young people and staff there.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A decade ago, federal officials uncovered evidence of abuse at two Wisconsin juvenile detention centers, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake in northern Wisconsin. Authorities used excessive solitary confinement, pepper spray, and other forms of abuse.
One federal judge said the convicted domestic terrorist, Ted Kaczynski, had less confinement than children at the Wisconsin facilities. The federal court ordered a consent decree, which required reforms and monitoring of the facilities for almost a decade.
Last week, U.S. District Judge James Peterson ended that federal monitoring, ruling that the facilities are now complying with the law. To help us understand what happened at the facilities and what their conditions are like now, we turn to Kate Burdick. She's a senior attorney at the Juvenile Law Center advocating for youth in the justice and child welfare systems. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate, can you take us back a decade or so? What was going on at Lincoln Hill and Copper Lake that led ultimately to this court-appointed oversight?
Yeah, well, this is a milestone moment to get to this point, given where we started. There were many concerns coming from the community about the draconian conditions that young people were experiencing at Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills a decade plus ago. We were hearing about youth being pepper sprayed regularly. Solitary confinement was rampant. Youth were subject to mechanical restraints and strip searches on a regular basis. And so we and our partners at ACLU of Wisconsin and Quarles and Brady decided that we would file a lawsuit on behalf of the young people at the facilities demanding changes.
This led to a consent decree being put in place. For people who aren't familiar with the legal term there, what is a consent decree?
A consent decree is essentially a settlement agreement in a lawsuit, but where there's continued court oversight. It's a court-ordered settlement. So in our case, various things happened along the way, but eventually the parties came to an agreement about how the facilities would have to treat young people at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake moving forward. But instead of that being just a private agreement, it was ordered by the court that they have to would have to comply with the terms of the agreement. And the court was, as part of that, regularly receiving reports from a monitor that the court appointed and also maintaining oversight and enforcement powers.
What were the changes that were made over that time while that observation was taking place under this consent decree?
So there was progress made over time, slow but steady. And what I mentioned before that when we started, youth were subject to solitary confinement. For example, some young people were being held in their cells for up to 60 days, sometimes only getting out of their room for an hour a day. And during that hour, they might have been in mechanical restraints, chained to a desk, sometimes told not to speak to other young people. So now, as part of the consent decree, over time, solitary confinement has been dramatically curtailed. It is no longer allowed to be used as a punishment at all. And the limited amount that it is still allowed to be used for is essentially as a cool down for a very short period of time when a young person is found to be posing an imminent physical and serious threat to others. And so it has gone from being something where a huge percentage of young people at the facility were subject to weeks or months of solitary confinement in extremely dire conditions. And now they are required to have much more limited use of putting youth in their rooms.
One concern was over the use of pepper spray. You mentioned it was the use was pretty widespread early on. There were concerns raised, including from some state lawmakers, that we might be going too far here, that there are more conditions where pepper spray might help maintain safety for the people incarcerated there, for the staff themselves. What are your thoughts on the way the pepper spray issue has been handled under this decree?
I think it's a huge step forward that the facilities were able to completely eliminate pepper spray. And reverting back to pepper spray now, or any of the other harmful conditions that the consent decree had outlawed, that's not the answer. They didn't contribute to a safe environment before the settlement, and they won't now. In fact, making the whole culture better at the facilities is what has allowed for there to be, you know, an overall improvement in safety for the young people and staff there.
And of course, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake were scheduled to be closed years ago. The deadline keeps getting moved back, but eventually, maybe in the next couple of years, that'll happen. Other, I think, smaller facilities are in the works. What lessons would you want to see the Department of Corrections learn from what has changed at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake for whatever replaces those two facilities?
So I think first and foremost, this lesson that treating youth appropriately is what keeps youth and staff and everyone safe. We don't need to go back to, as I mentioned, pepper spray or solitary or mechanical restraints, or essentially harm youth, cause further trauma in order to meet those goals. At the same time, I think it's very important here that as the facilities transition to a close, which is long overdue, and the state moves towards this model of new facilities, that we don't lose sight of the overall goal here, which is really that no child should be growing up inside behind bars, right? We want a world in which we are investing in education and supportive programs that keep youth in their homes and their communities, not going back to the failed model of incarceration. Research shows that locking youth up actually increases recidivism, whereas community-based alternatives to incarceration have been shown to be highly effective and cost-effective as well.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
That was Kate Burdick, senior attorney at the Juvenile Law Center. We're talking about a federal court decision to end the monitoring of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake juvenile detention facilities. Now let's hear the perspective of Dane County Juvenile Court Judge Everett Mitchell. Judge Mitchell, thanks for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here with you.
Now, you are in the position of handing out sentences in some cases to minors who come before you in the court. How do you weigh that responsibility, given that they have committed a crime that requires some kind of reaction to they are minors?
I think the statute, the juvenile code, especially 938, allows for us to look at seven factors. And one of the things that we're supposed to look at is how do we assist in the development of competency so that young people, one, don't reoffend, but also don't create more victims. So what you're trying to do is figure out what services are available that can correct the issue that brought the particular young person into court in the first place. And if you can address the underlying trauma, which we see a lot of in our cases, because many of the kids are what we call dual kids. So they started in the child welfare system and then ended up picking up a crime at the age of 10 or so. And then most of them have a lot of trauma, a lot of educational deficiencies with their IEP programs that may or may not be serving their educational needs, lack of medication, lack of stability in their own housing or family systems. So you're trying to figure out in the midst of a crime that was committed, how can you provide other things to support the young person so they don't reoffend again?
When we had all this news coming out about a decade ago about Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, were you looking at that and saying, hey, does sending a kid there meet the criteria you just outlined?
10 years ago is when I started, and I remember my first visit to Lincoln Hills is shortly after I was elected, and I made it my business to try to not send children there because children were being abused. They were not receiving the medication that they needed to receive for their mental health. They were being housed in what they call, we know as solitary confinement, but they had given it a new term called it residential housing for 23 out of 24 hours a day. They weren't given the education programming. And so for me, a lot of the young people were coming back. They were reoffending again. So they weren't developing competency. They were learning how to be better criminals. And so 100% of the young people who were coming back, and I want to say this, 100% of the young people who were coming back at that time were reoffending or gravitating to more serious crimes.
With that in mind, with the consent decree signed and in place, do you feel more comfortable with the idea that, hey, Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake could meet some of the needs for kids that not 100% of them would come back and be likely to reoffend?
I think between the time when you had the consent decree and what we have now, we've been able to effectively think about different strategies for before we, take a kid up to Lincoln Hills. I think the more appropriate places is for us is try to take advantage of some of the more regional locations that we need to support, because sending a kid 2 hours north really does break them away from their community and their connections. So I do think that some of the processes that they put in place are more effective than they were before. So DBT therapy to delective behavioral therapy is important, making sure that they have really access to more outside time and really limit the amount of residential or secure housing so that they have more time. It's just some of the kids, once they're mixed in certain populations, it just inevitably creates a level of criminality that we just try to avoid. So I never feel comfortable having to send a child into any kind of incarcerated setting. I think what we saw in Racine, I don't know if you've covered that, but the Racine had the new facility that was just opened up, and just the attack on that young man is a reminder to us that even the most beautifully laid out intentions and spaces can still recreate more trauma that does not aid in reducing the criminality of young people. But in many ways, it adds to their belief that no one is listening and no one cares. So why should they stop?
Are you optimistic that we're going to have a better system in place that keeps kids closer to home, that steers as many of them as possible away from any form of incarceration?
My hope is that we've learned how to better organize our systems in general so that we're reducing the crimes in our communities. I know when when they had proposed the budget, and I'm grateful that the governor reduced the amount, but at one time it was $1,000. They charged $1,254 a day to incarcerate one youth, which was close to $468,000 a year to incarcerate one youth. And, you know, that's, you know, almost $500,000 per kid. And so the recognition of how can we use those resources differently is what I think is most appropriate so that we can, you know, be in the front of these issues. So working with our local school districts, working with our community-led partners, our nonprofit organizations, our schools, and, you know, and strengthening some of our core families that we see this pattern emerging and get in front of it so that we're not, you know, spending $500,000 to lock up a child and taking that money away from the community and the vital services that every community needs.
Briefly, Judge Mitchell, what is one thing that you think the public or maybe lawmakers misunderstand or don't understand about young people in the juvenile justice system?
It is the fact that many of them come from the child welfare system. And when we're not able to effectively address the trauma within the child welfare system, they inevitably start picking up crimes. In Wisconsin, it could be at the age of 10 years old. And by not investing in that, those trauma-informed practices up front, we're basically passing these traumatized children from one system to the next. And then we can't act surprised when they turn 17 and have created more crimes in the adult system that perpetually keeps them in the cycle almost for many of them for the rest of their lives. So we have to, you know, really be more intentional about our young people and the pain that they experience younger, and really be more aggressive in making sure those resources are available so communities can meet their needs.
Judge Mitchell, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Judge Everett Mitchell, Dane County Juvenile Court Judge. Now we bring on State Senator LaTanya Johnson, a Democrat who represents a Milwaukee area district. She's a member of the Senate's Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now, the legislature voted to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. This all happened years ago. We're way past the deadline. Why are they still operating?
Well, one of the reasons that it's still operating is because we don't have a place currently right now for those kids to go. So we have to have at least two Type 1 facilities, which are the maximum secure facilities for juvenile detention, in place before we can close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. One of those facilities that'll be here in Milwaukee, it is expected to be done and open by the end of this year. So we'll be transitioning at least 32 of those kids to that facility when it opens later this year. But Madison has to build their Type 1 secure detention facility, and that's not expected to be complete and operational until 2029. So it appears that we will have to have Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake open at least until 2029.
What other kinds of reforms do you want to see when it comes to Wisconsin's juvenile justice system?
I would like to see reforms, especially in terms of education and making sure that those kids that are sentenced have the opportunity to get their GED or high school diploma. Making sure that every child that goes in, especially those kids that are there for a duration of time, even if those classes have to be accelerated, we don't want those kids to go in and then come out and not have that opportunity to get that done during their years of confinement. That's first and foremost. I want to make sure that it's safe working conditions also for the workers who are responsible for housing these kids, too. We know that we've had issues with safeties and concerns around safety, but making sure that this is not only a workable situation for the kids, but also for the workers, too, that are responsible for their care.
It seemed like there's pretty general agreement that Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake weren't working right, that they needed to be closed. I think a fair amount of bipartisan agreement there. Do you feel like there's that kind of bipartisan support and attention going on right now to make sure that the new institutions, the bigger ones, maybe smaller regional ones, get it right?
I do think that it's the responsibility is there to make sure that it gets done and it's done correctly, because let's be real, to have that consent decree on Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, it cost taxpayer more than $25 million in legal fees and settlements related to the abuse and maltreatment that took place there. So there is an incentive to get it right. Also, when it comes to the Joint Finance Committee, making sure that the dollars that are requested to get Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake closed, making sure that money is actually allocated in a timely manner. And we haven't seen that in the past. We know that with the cost of inflation, the cost of supplies, these costs go up. And that's what we saw in the building of the Milwaukee facility. What was once requested at $46 million is now costing us roughly $76 million plus to get that job done. And now we see the request for, or the money being allocated for the Madison facility. The longer it takes for us to get this right, the longer it takes for us to allocate those funds, the longer Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake stays open to these use, which will cost us, cost taxpayers even more money, especially in terms of the daily rate and the operational cost. So I think that there is motivation there to make sure that we get this done right, because at the end of the day, it's costing taxpayers a lot of money when we get it wrong.
Senator Johnson, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Senator LaTanya Johnson is a Democrat representing a Milwaukee area district. Earlier, we heard from Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell and Kate Burdick, a senior attorney at Juvenile Law Center. Wisconsin Today invited State Corrections Secretary Jared Hoy to the show, but he was not available. In a joint statement with Governor Tony Evers, Hoy celebrated the end of the court supervision, but added, quote, "Our work is not done. Wisconsin has made a commitment to our youth to use evidence-based practices and create the supports that will allow these youth to return to and thrive in their communities."
Coming up, last month's frigid weather put a lot of strain on warming centers around Wisconsin. We check in with two shelters in the state.
We have yet to reach capacity of both shelters, but the need has grown tremendously within the last year.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Early last month, the state was blanketed by a wave of extreme cold, with temperatures in places reaching into the negative 30s with wind chill.
Those can be dangerous conditions for anybody, but they're especially dangerous for people without housing, and that's where warming centers come in.
Two directors of warming centers in Wisconsin join us now for a look at the services they provide and why their capacity was stretched thin during the cold spell.
Carla Hine is the coordinator of the La Crosse Warming Center, and Taylee Proctor is the coordinator for Good Shepherd Shelter in Wausau. Taylee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Carla, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carla, why are warming centers critical, obviously, in Wisconsin through the winter months? How much of a difference do they make?
Huge, huge impact in the community, in the understanding of what unsheltered neighbors go through. We are, quote unquote, the overflow shelter, especially here in La Crosse to the Salvation Army. We also are a no barrier shelter here in La Crosse with the warming center. So we allow everybody and anybody to come in regardless of past experiences and or how they present at the door.
And Taylee, other than a warm place to stay, what other kinds of services do warming centers like yours provide to people?
Yeah, we provide shower services, laundry services. We also have a warm meal each night, and then we have a cold cart breakfast.
And Carla, people might listen and think, oh, this is a shelter. Well, there's technically a difference, I understand, between a warming center and a shelter. What's the difference?
Yeah, and I use the words interchangeably. Oftentimes people aren't aware. A warming center is a night-by-night shelter that is often, ours is a permanent fixture here on La Crosse, luckily, but it is often set up as an overflow to like a regular shelter where people can stay 24/7. It also has different zoning laws, be it with the city or the county that the warming center is located in, than a shelter.
Taylee, as we're talking now, it's pretty cold in Wisconsin. It was brutally cold over the last couple of weeks. What did that end up meaning for your shelter and your warming center in Wausau?
We were in overflow, so that means that we can exceed our normal capacity, which is 30, so we went up to 40. Thankfully, we did not hit 40. We are also an overflow shelter to the other shelter in the area, which is the WMC shelter. I did get the information between both shelters. At one point, we saw 93 individuals seeking shelter.
And Carla, what did that really cold spell mean in La Crosse?
Yeah, so here in La Crosse, our warming center capacity is 34 on normal days. Overflow we go into when the temperatures are 15 degrees above zero or less. And we ended up with 44 people. Most nights we were turning away 5 to 6 individuals. Last Friday night, I believe, we had 13 individuals that we had worked out with the Salvation Army, where they then ended up having an overflow to our overflow, just so that we could keep everybody indoors. Because what we see for like medical needs and conditions with people staying at the warming center, we see mental illness. We also see addiction type things. But in the winter months, especially with the warming center, when we're just trying to keep people alive and out of the elements, we have seen a lot of, unfortunately, frostbite. And in my time here, I have seen some amputations of fingers and toes of our guests.
Carla, you may have just answered this. I think in general, is there enough capacity for warming stations in La Crosse?
No, unfortunately, there is not. Over this entire season up to yesterday morning, we've had over 215 different individuals spend evenings with us for a shelter that on regular nights can occupy 34 and an overflow 44. So no, we are definitely not able to assist everyone who would and could use our services.
And what's the capacity like there in Wausau, Taylee, between your outfit and the others you've mentioned?
Yeah, so thankfully right now at this point between the two shelters, we've been able to help everybody. I believe over at WMC, they can see the capacity up to 80 individuals, and we can go up to 40. So thankfully, we have yet to reach capacity of both shelters, but the need is growing. I can tell you last year, we were the only emergency night-by-night shelter within the area, and often we were turning people away because we only had the capacity of 40, but I can tell you I definitely was not turning away 50 people a night. So the need has grown tremendously within the last year.
Taylee, what would it take to have more capacity for your institution or another one to open another center? That's probably a pretty tall order, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, definitely. So unfortunately, here in the building that we are in, we don't have the means to expand. So we are in a building called the Community Partners Campus. I refer to it almost as a resource mall. It is absolutely incredible. So within our building, we also have, not with Catholic Charities, there are other organizations and entities, but we have Neighbor's Place, which is a food pantry, Baby's Place, where people can get diapers and formula. We also have the free clinic in here, along with Catholic Charities St. Lawrence programming, which is financial counseling. We have our adoption and pregnancy support out of here, also Beyond Shelter. So it's very busy over here. So unfortunately, we don't have much room to expand. Right now, WMC is a temporary shelter until Bridge Street Mission actually takes over. So they will be partially emergency shelter and then transitional living as well.
And Carla, do you see any movement to expand capacity at your or other organizations providing warming stations and shelter in La Crosse?
Warming center-wise, we are blessed to have a lease that allows us to have the warming center here. I think that's the biggest hurdle for in La Crosse is that a lot of people understand and see the need for needing warming centers. However, having them in your backyard is often something that is struggled with to find additional space for a center to open up. Here, realistically, our building is at max capacity via the fire department. However, we have at Catholic Charities in La Crosse, which is beautiful. Not only are the warming centers needed, Taylor kind of alluded to it, but this is the starting off point, right? Like this is like the worst day of your life is when you're coming in here, right? Like you've got nothing else, the family, friends, support, you might have lost it, what have you. So with Catholic Charities, we have, like transitional housing, as Taylor was saying, there's the Live By program where you have like case management, which is some of the services here at the Warming Center that we have partnered with La Crosse, the city of La Crosse, as well as like Balance of State, coordinated entry to get people on list, to get them in touch with the people who can get them to that next level of living care, where they can get in a home, where they have a social worker who is doing case management with them. So we are trying to do a lot of those warm handoffs. And that starts by different partners coming into our agency, which has been absolutely phenomenal.
Carla, on a practical level, how do you get the word out to people who need these kinds of services? They might not have been without housing for very long. This might be all new to them. How do you find the target audience that can benefit from your services?
Normally, it's word of mouth. The guests that stay with us at the shelter are oftentimes the people who are referring others to our agency. Also, we have a resource center. It's called Reach in La Crosse, and they are wonderful. It's a place where people can go, even if they aren't experiencing homelessness per se, but they're experiencing homeless instability. And so it kind of gives all of the options of what is available, a starting point for people. And those are a lot of the partners that we work with. Also, the La Crosse Library. As a lot of us probably know, libraries have become places where, you know, if there aren't daytime shelters like there aren't in La Crosse, those are services that a lot of our unsheltered population uses. So we have an amazing partnership with the La Crosse County Library System as well.
And Taylor, what kind of outreach do you do to make sure that people who need your services can get to them?
Definitely. So like I mentioned, we're kind of in like this resource mall, which is amazing. So up front, we have plenty of flyers. We also, the collaboration here in WASA is absolutely amazing when it comes with other organizations and entities. So I know a lot of the other nonprofits in the area are constantly referring. Like Carla had mentioned, word of mouth. We have good communications. Over with the other shelter as well, because sometimes, you know, somebody might be having a rough night, it might not be a good fit over there, so they come by us and we're totally okay with that. But I would say just a lot of collaboration with the community and word of mouth.
We are talking about warming centers in Wisconsin with Carla Hine with La Crosse Warming Center and Taylor Proctor with Good Shepherd Shelter in Wausau. I think a lot of times people think of homelessness, oh, that's a big city problem. And in Wisconsin, maybe that's Milwaukee and Madison. Well, it seems to be all over the place. Taylor, let's start with you. How much of a problem is homelessness for people, and how aware is the community that that problem exists?
I would say our community is aware. However, I feel like there's always a stigmatism around homelessness. So I think the reason behind homelessness isn't as well known as there is a homelessness crisis going on. So with that, I think our community has been pretty involved. Every single time that there's ever been an ask put out there to our community, they have been absolutely amazing at reaching that need. However, the need, it's growing. And I'd say probably the biggest need that is needed in our area is safe and affordable housing.
And Carla, how about in La Crosse?
Yeah, we are very fortunate. I don't know that our community might say that all the time, that we do have the experience and the knowledge that there is homelessness. It's in the downtown area, and so people are well aware of it. I sometimes don't know that everybody is equipped with what I would say the best response, like when they meet somebody who is homeless. I always tell people, this is, you know, I say, I don't give them money, give them resources. You can contact Catholic Charities, Warming Center, and La Crosse. We have resources that you can hand out to people. You know, tell them where the REACH Resource Center is. Show them where the Salvation Army is located. So a lot of members of our community have limited knowledge of everything that is going on. The other thing that I would say, and it alludes exactly to what Taylee said, is that there's a housing crisis. And so we do have people at the Warming Center, and a lot of the guests at the Warming Center have jobs. They have some sort of income with like a Social Security or an income or even a retirement or a pension. You know, we have people who had lucrative careers who end up at the Warming Center. And sometimes just finding housing that is A, affordable for them, and B, a landlord that is willing to give second chances and not necessarily see the person as what their background or their financial record says of them, but to see the human being standing before them. I think that is definitely something that could continue to grow within our community and our business association here.
Carla, people might be listening, maybe in your area or elsewhere in the state, and thinking, hey, I would like to help out with the warming centers or these other services. What is the best way for a community member to get involved?
Best way is you could potentially, you know, reach out to your 211 if you're looking to volunteer through Catholic Charities. Our website is ccclse.org. That's in for the Diocese of La Crosse. You could look up Catholic Charities in your area. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't say this for everybody. However, if you feel comfortable, even asking, you know, somebody who you know or think or have seen on the streets, and just say, hey, where is it that you spend your nights, or where do you spend your days, and finding those places and then reaching out to those entities that are organizing that particular place and seeing how you can get involved. Monetary donations are always necessary. It takes staff that is trained to know how to work with our guests, to know how to get them the best resources all the time, but also just, you know, understanding that an unsheltered person is nothing different. They are no different than you or I, other than they don't have four walls and a roof. They are, you know, us seeing ourselves in the mirror just without a house. And having that understanding, sometimes it's just giving a smile to somebody and just being supportive.
We'll leave it there. Taylee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Carla, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Carla Hine is the coordinator of the La Crosse Warming Center, and Taylee Proctor is coordinator for Good Shepherd Shelter in Wausau. We've been talking about warming centers around Wisconsin and the capacity challenges they face during extreme cold weather like we had last month here in Wisconsin.
Everyone has a life story to tell, but it can be hard to document your own life. Where do you start? What do you include? What do you leave out?
Turns out there's a class for that. Thursday on the program, we'll hear from a retired English teacher about his class that helps seniors write about their lives. We'll also talk with some students to learn why documenting their lives is important and what they want to convey.
Your experience can be part of the segment. Are you working on a document that captures your life? Do you keep a diary, or have you been working on a memoir? What is it like to write about your life events Or perhaps you've interviewed a family member or friend to help them write about a life event.
Share your story about a personal storytelling project. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Joe Tarr, and Royce Padeswa.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.